on financial services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week. It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the best Tuesday you've had all week. Today, joining me in studio,
Matthew Dixon.
All right. Well, today we have got probably the most interesting show you've heard at least ever.
Maybe in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, maybe the most, you'll decide. You'll decide if it's the most interesting show ever. But it's interesting to us. For sure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Matt,
yeah.
Talk to me about this. You know, I had the most thrilling show planned. Thrills, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was like, hey, what if we talked about life insurance? Everybody loves that, right? Super stoked about it. And Matt's like, no, wait.
Right?
I have something even funner.
We could even say it's a stroke of genius.
Yeah.
I had this concept running through my mind at the 11th hour, and it was... Hey, I don't think a lot of people know how to have a conversation with a financial advisor. They don't know what things to ask versus like what things maybe shouldn't I ask, because that's kind of a waste of my time. So I'm like, what are some just basic things that we can kind of run through where you get to have a more meaningful experience with a financial advisor?
You really think that this is the more funnerest version than life insurance?
I think we're probably going to get to both. I think this could be like a cocktail show where it's like...
The truth is, I actually think this is a lot more fun than life insurance. I mean, life insurance is interesting to me only because like there's all these things that people don't get about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? If you really want a show about that, let us know. You can send us a text or whatever, 541-375-0898. You'd be like, no, I got to hear about life insurance,
yeah.
Right? Like we can do a show about that. Or we can do a separate, you know, YouTube video or something.
Mm-hmm.
But not right now.
Okay.
Right now, Matt, I love the way you have framed this up. Because so what I'm seeing right now in front of me is this list of questions. By the way, two sets of questions.
Yeah.
Two sets. Talk to me about this.
Yeah. Well, so everyone is always like talking about, well, what do I say to my potential financial advisor? Like, how do I interview them, right? But what you don't get all of the time is the flip side of that. And no one's ever talking about the questions that you really shouldn't ask a financial advisor. That, I think, is really overlooked. And why does it matter? I've had so many different clients, you know, or prospects, I guess, come in, and I'll ask them the question of like, hey, tell me a little bit about how I can help you out or what it is that you're looking for. Talk to me about your situation. And they might kind of start in the wrong spot, or they'll just flat out say to me, I have no idea. I don't know what to say. And so I think that the conversation today could be really helpful for our listeners, because it kind of lays the groundwork of like, you know, for the person that's just walking through those doors for the first time, how do I have a good conversation? And even for the person who has maybe had a financial advisor for 2 or 3 years, how do you have better conversations with your advisor, right? So it's not just for the newbie that's having a consultation. It's also, how do you get more meaningful dialogue when you're sitting there with your financial advisor going over a portfolio maybe you've had for 2 or 3 years?
Right. Okay. So that's the idea then is, hey, maybe you've been working with somebody, maybe you haven't, but one way or the other, we're going to improve the conversation?
I think so. Yeah, let's improve the language.
No, I'm just kidding. This sounds fun. So with this set of questions that you've shown me, though, I've noticed that there's two primary categories, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's questions that are good questions.
Right.
And then there's questions that are bad questions.
Yes.
Oh, I got to know, like, how do we tackle this?
Well, how about I interview you a little bit, and then maybe when you feel like it, chime in and interview me. And they don't even have to be questions off of this list.
Maybe we should play the game of, well, tell you what, let's take turns. We'll ask a question,
I can
see how
do
the
that.
Other answers, yeah. And then we'll tell the audience, was this a good question or not? And you guys can decide. It may be obvious, but actually it may not be.
Okay, I want to start with kind of the rip the Band-Aid off, right?
Okay.
A lot of people don't know what happens when they die and what happens with their money. And so there's kind of this uncertainty of like, how do things transition to heirs? I think that that's worth talking about. So if I'm sitting here and I'm interviewing you, Dave, mm-hmm. and you're like, I walk in, I'm a prospect. I'm like, hey, I really need help understanding the process of passing assets on when I pass. Where do you even start with that conversation?
Okay. That was so not a direct question,
it's
but it's
not.
It's a good topic. So without like answering the question in and of itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like at a high level, I'm glad that somebody would ask that question, right? Because what it tells you is, okay, hey, it's not just about what do we do right now, but it's like someday if I'm not here, now what?
Yeah.
Okay. And the answer usually comes with some qualifications, right? Like it will kind of depends on how the accounts are structured, right? Some accounts have instructions associated with
mm-hmm.
them. So they may have instructions that we often call it a beneficiary designation.
Right.
But who's going to take over if it's not me, right?
How many times have you seen that beneficiary designation be incorrect to what that person really wants to happen with their money? Because I've seen that where it's
it can happen. So it's like not up to date, right?
Yeah.
It's not like the form is broken.
Like your
it's
ex-wife,
like you put the wrong thing on it.
Your ex-wife
right?
is the beneficiary. That's not good.
Yeah. So I've seen people that are just sort of negligent in their paperwork and mm-hmm. they don't keep it up to date. And so it's like, here's the thing. You did. So like, you don't know that it didn't work out the way you wanted to, but your family's not real pleased.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, yeah. Do you have the paperwork in good order? Is it up to date? If you're working with a professional, they ought to be kind of challenging you on that from time to time and just pulling it out in front of you and throwing it in there and say, hey, does this still say who it's supposed to say?
The thing that I think gets overlooked the most and people really end up having the most questions about is the estate planning side of things, where it's like, well, what happens to the house and all the other assets, right? Because sometimes people don't have a will. They don't have a trust. There's no set of instructions for what happens when they die.
Yeah. And see, I love because this happens sometimes where people will just sort of skip over things or they'll assume things that work a certain way and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to your investment accounts, the question is there direct associated instructions with it in the form of like beneficiary designation? Or sometimes we have something called a transfer on death instruction that sort of predefines who gets something.
Right.
But if that doesn't happen, right, you may have an account that doesn't have those things defined, then the question is that account going to be governed by a will, right?
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? If you don't have a will, you still have a will, right? It's just going to be whatever the laws say, right? It's
mm-hmm.
going to be the intestate laws. So, I don't have an actual stated will of what I want to have happen. So
yeah.
we're going to follow the laws to distribute whatever assets you have to whomever is eligible according to the law. Otherwise, you create a will and it instructs things. But it's got to go to a court and a probate judge is going to look at this and make determinations about how to get things done. And why? Because you can't sign stuff when you're dead. So you can't transfer title if you're dead.
Right.
Okay. One of the ways that you can mitigate that is through proper estate planning. You can use things like trust documents. Corporate documents can do this as well. So maybe you have a corporation, S-Corp, LLC, something like that, that might be useful in transferring because there's sort of instructions associated
mm-hmm.
in the operating agreement. But those are things that you try to coordinate. And so what happens? It depends on what you stated or not stated that can determine who ends up getting the stuff. And I think if you're working with a good planner and that person's working with a good legal team as well, then you should be able to get everything structured in such a way that it largely goes to whom you want it to go to. And then the key also is, can you avoid giving more to the IRS than you have to?
Right.
Right. So like, we're not going to not pay our taxes. That's not the point. But let's not volunteer extra,
mm-hmm.
right? And that good planning can reduce your tax
liability. That's a good one. I've got another question for you.
Okay.
Are you ready for me to hit you with it?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to kind of lump two questions together, but I think that they are really asking similar things.
Okay.
So what if someone walks in and says, hey, Dave, I don't want to run out of money. So how do you help me not run out of money and even taking that a step further, how do you protect my money when it's a bad year, right? Like the stock market or the bond market's not doing well. Like, what are some of the things that you might do as an advisor that helps protect my money and make sure that I don't run out?
This one's super easy. We just forbid you from spending it and you have to work forever.
There you go.
Right? So that's
the things
it.
That just, everyone wants to hear.
Yeah, like you just can't have it and you can't spend it and you have to keep working forever.
I will give you credit. Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay. The one thing that I have heard every advisor in the office say on more than one occasion to a lot of different people, it's a common thing that I think we end up saying a lot, is it's okay to spend money. They're like, if you have a lot of money, typically, like the reason you got there is because you were really good at not spending it for a really long time.
Right.
And so I think a lot of the times people end up with an advisor having these conversations because they actually need the opposite. Like, can you please tell me it's okay to finally spend this?
Yeah. It's tricky when somebody's developed really good saving habits and really good
right.
sort of gratification deferral. Mm-hmm. Right? Hey, I'm just good at delaying gratifications. Yeah, but you may delay it forever. So yeah. Sometimes we do have to have the opposite. So the question
is the opposite. Like, how do you actually make sure that there's kind of some guardrails in place and that I'm not going to go broke?
Yeah. And the answer is, by one, you have to stay in touch with the client. Understand what the spending requirements are and then understand what
the— Because that can change.
It really can. And then you got to kind of have a sense of what is the capacity of the portfolio, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have $100,000 and you're trying to take $50,000 a year out of it, that's not likely to be sustained, right? It's just too aggressive. You know, you take half the money out every year. You got to double your money to get back to where you started. Yet that's not a realistic expectation for your investments,
mm-hmm.
Unless you're planning to live less than a year, right? You know,
right.
So like, okay, well, if you're in terminal and something like that, that's awful to think about, but that may change your planning. But for most of us, where we don't have a stated expiration date, and we're kind of figuring it out as we go, what you look for is what is a reasonable rate of withdrawal, and
okay.
how much money do you need for your lifestyle? And then you sort of run some analysis. And we've got some pretty good statistical tracking mechanism, I'll try to call them. I'm trying to think of the right term for it. But basically, there's some pretty good financial rules of thumb to give an indication of how likely is it that something will be sustainable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we know that as long as you stay below a certain threshold, you're in pretty good shape. You start getting much above that, and it becomes less probable that you're successful. Right. And so part of our job, if you're a good financial advisor, I think, is to set realistic expectations and then help somebody to live within their means.
That's a good response. I like that. Now, we'll flip it around.
Okay.
Are there any like questions out there that you feel like someone like talking to an advisor really should be asking? What are some like really big ones that you find to be valuable?
These are fun. So there's some great ones out there. I want to do this. I'm looking at the clock.
Okay.
Why don't we take that and I'm going to cliffhanger this one so we can come back.
So we're going to find out Dave's favorite question that you should ask.
We'll talk about like, what are some great questions to ask advisors, or what's one that I think more people should ask? We'll do that, but we'll catch on the flip side. So stick around. We'll be right back. And so between now and then, you know the deal. You're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM, 1240. Take you in.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Get caught up at the podcast. Go to littlejohnfs.com tomorrow and you'll be able to catch it. But today, Matt and I are covering questions that we ought to ask our financial advisors and some of the questions that you really shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so you asked one of these, what's a question that everybody should ask to their advisor? I don't know that there's a magic bullet question.
No.
But if you want an open-ended question that will really reveal a lot,
mm-hmm.
ask an advisor, how do you take care of me as a fiduciary? And what does that look like at your firm?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I feel like a lot of financial advisors these days claim to be a fiduciary, mm-hmm. right? But when you start looking at like maybe how they're compensated or like how are they, you know, operating as a business, it's not always necessarily aligned with, yeah. you know, the client. And, you know, you'd asked earlier today, you know, privately behind the door, like, what do you guys love about this place?
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that I touched on was, you know, I like the fact that, you know, we're not, you know, Justin and I, for example, we're not out here, you know, really incentivized to like go sell someone something, right? Where I feel like a lot of advisors are like they've got something to sell you and that's how they're getting paid. Yeah. But not all firms are that way.
So, I mean, I'm going to take a moment, break from script, and just talk about how our firm was formed and why this idea was unique,
mm-hmm.
right? And let me also take a step even further back. Why did I suggest this question? Why is this a good question?
I think it's I think it's a good question because a lot of people, in my opinion, claim to be a fiduciary, but they're not, right? Like, they're not actually aligned in the client's best interest.
Or maybe they are, but what happens is, there's still certain incentives
the lines
that
kinda
are kind of
blurred.
Tricky. Yeah. My experience with the industry, and you know, I've been doing this for 25 years now.
Right.
Right. Which is crazy to say because I'm not that old. Come on. But maybe I am. I've watched the industry grow up a lot. I've watched it kind of mature from being, if you can believe this, when I very first started my career, they were still trading, I believe, in like eighths. Right. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have stocks and bonds that were being traded by the pennies. And then they quickly converted to decimalization, right, as early in my career. Or maybe they had just changed, right? Because the study material still had like eighths in it when I was learning this stuff. And then it transitioned to decimalization. And for all of us now, that's like, well, that's just standard, right? Like it wasn't. It was not standard that you'd have one penny in between transactions. It was bigger gaps because what that did was it left a certain amount of, I'll call it meat on the bone for the various parties that were being paid to make these transactions happen. But computerization sped things up and it eliminated a lot of the manual work. And so that ultimately was passed on to the consumer in the form of savings and tighter margins in brokerage. So the stockbroker world really has transitioned to this advisory world. And now we've seen this regulatory push for fiduciary work, okay? But a lot of the firms haven't caught up. How do firms grow? They usually hire people and then say, go out and find everybody you know and convince them to invest with you. And when they invest with you, you'll get paid,
mm-hmm.
okay? But for a lot of folks, they don't have a big group of people to serve. They have to go out one at a time. And what people don't understand is, as a general rule of thumb, let's talk about the high end of things. I'm going to make this really like an expensive version of this because like this is more expensive than our firm charges. But I'm going to use a high number just to give you a perspective on how thin the margins really are. It is not uncommon for a young person in their 20s maybe that wants to get started in this business to never make it because if they go in to become an advisor, they're going to make on the upper end 2% of the assets that they're going to manage for their clients, upper end.
Mm-hmm.
So a client comes in and says, well, I'm going to make a $500 a month investment, okay? And you think, okay, well, I'm going to get 2% of $500, right? $500, so 2% of that, you're going to make roughly $10 mm-hmm. every time that that client makes a deposit.
For the year.
For the year. You're going to make 1/12 of that. So you're going to make about 80 cents, 75, 80 cents a month on that client.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How many of those clients do you need to put in place to make enough money to not starve?
Right.
Right. Now, if you could make it 3 or 4 years and stack a bunch of people up, all paying you $500 a month, it would eventually be worth something. But how do you do that? One person at a time, signing up one person at a time manually, right? If it takes you an hour per customer, you're making 75 cents an hour. How long can you hold your breath?
Right.
That's the issue. And so what happens is sales incentives creep in out of necessity. Mm-hmm. People have to find other products that will pay them more than that in order to survive and make it. And the reason our firm is unique is because like Justin or Matt, when they joined, I already had an existing group of clients that I was working with and they didn't have to make a sales quota because I said, can you please just help me? I'm overwhelmed.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And I needed help. And so you guys say like, yeah, let's do this. And so we work as a team and the incentive structure was really built around, let's just take care of the clients.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think there are great firms out there. I'm not saying that we're the only ones that are doing, you know, fiduciary business. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that was how it was born.
Right. But I would say that, you know, if you look at the industry as a whole, I think that that's not the most common structure.
It's like, really uncommon.
Yeah.
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 There are other team structures. They're usually pretty small. They're usually still driven a lot by production and there's mm-hmm. incentive programs and so forth.
Right.
You know, and it was just, you know, something that was important to me was I didn't want to get on this treadmill of you have to make a quota. I always felt like if you had to sell something to somebody by convincing them to do it, then you're doing it the wrong way, right? Like if I just educate somebody, it becomes obvious, right? Like, oh, this is the right fit for you. This is what you probably need to be doing. And they go, yeah, okay, let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, let me tell you why this is a great dog and pony show and you're going to want it.
Mm. That's good. Yeah. That's worth pointing out because if people understand the behind the scenes of how the business is running,
yeah.
I feel like they can make a better decision on if that aligns with their values.
That's why I like the question of how do you treat me as a fiduciary and how does your firm handle that, right?
Yeah.
Because you're really inviting somebody to say, talk to me about the way the business was designed and how you're going to protect my interests.
I've got another good question for you.
Okay.
Mr. Advisor Man over there.
Look out.
Okay. So talk to me about kind of some of the things that you watch or pay attention to that maybe the industry as a whole isn't hyper-focused on. Like, what are some of the ways that you kind of stand out as maybe a little bit different than your traditional advisor? Like, where are you looking and how does that maybe give you an edge?
You know, I think I know the question because we've talked about some other things, but I think I'm going to answer it slightly different than what you're going to expect.
Sure.
The design of our firm, first of all, included doing some of the money management in-house, right?
Correct.
A lot of firms are they don't do a lot of money management.
They mainly do relationship management, and then they sub the investments out to a mutual fund or some other, you know, third party that's going to do all the trading and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it's not to say that we don't partner with others for certain categorical
like high level stuff that we can't do at scale.
Well, like as an example. Trying to buy individual high-yield bonds for an entire group of clients is pretty hard to do.
Right.
So oftentimes it makes more sense to buy a portfolioed solution, which can come through an institutional desk in the form of a mutual fund or exchange-traded fund. We don't buy mutual funds very often for different reasons that I'm not going to go into. But that can oftentimes be more cost effective for the customer than buying the individual issues.
Mm-hmm.
So we might do it in that case because there's economies of scale that are actually cheaper. So we're able to sort of, even though there's some management fees associated with the third party, if they can do it better than we can, it's better for
or
the client.
Or if they can do it a lot cheaper.
Correct,
for
cheaper.
The yeah.
Yeah, right. Hedging is one of those examples. You know, trying to buy a lot of options like calls and puts and stuff at scale doesn't always work as well as if you were to just buy it in a product,
mm-hmm.
right? So those are some examples where we would partner rather than trying to reproduce it internally. But I think the question there's other parts of it that I guess are important to me. Like why would we? I think I'm losing the question in here too because I get sidetracked by the why the investment part of it is so critical.
I can answer it on my end.
What was the rest of the question?
Well, the question was really just kind of like, what are you watching that other advisors aren't?
Yeah.
I'll give you mine.
Go ahead.
And this sounds crazy, but hear me out. I kind of like to look at where are these conspiracy theories throwing darts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even though a lot of them are just crazy conspiracy theories where when you start to triangulate, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I do think that there's stuff that goes on behind the scenes that the mainstream media is just not going to talk about that really does affect the economy and the markets at large. And so if you can kind of just at least be listening to it and seeing if it vets out, you can kind of start to get a handle, I think, on where things are going based on some of the stuff that's being talked about that's not right in the middle of the mainstream media. That's one of them.
Yeah. I like the idea of reading between the lines a little bit.
That's what I'm trying to say, I guess. Yeah.
The other, the reason it's hard for me to answer this, because I don't think we're the only ones that do this, right? I think other advisors probably do some of this too, but I really do try to take a step back and look at the big picture of how things are developing. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about interest rates. That to me is a symptom. I'm talking about, for example, let me just give you a theoretical example.
Yeah,
I have for a while now thought that how we store energy is critical to our economy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not just the production of energy, but how we store it, because we want to see more electric vehicles and things because it represents a cleaner way to do things, at least in theory. Well, then we're going to have a better way to store energy.
So you're really looking and analyzing what patterns and what trends are actually theoretically possible.
Yes.
Versus just like a pipe dream.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but I could tell you that if we need to do that, then there's some R&D on batteries, but there's also going to be a transition from rare earth elements. It's like, what elements are they going to need to be? Who are the players
right,
involved?
Because
what are
the regulations? Because you were one of the people that never really jumped on this all green bandwagon. And it wasn't because you didn't like the idea of it.
It was never actually feasible.
You were like, listen, like the grid can't sustain
right.
what the mandates are pushing for. Like California saying we're going to be 100% electric in X number
like,
of years.
Yeah, you mechanically can't.
You're
right?
Like, your grid can't handle that.
Yeah, it's structurally impossible.
Right? Because it's already tapped out on energy. They're saying, please don't charge your car during the day. Charge it at night. Like, we're not even nearly 100% electric, and we're already depleted the system almost virtually completely.
Yeah. And so that, to me, is one of those examples where the rhetoric, like the political rhetoric, didn't match the like actual structural possibilities
right.
underneath it. And so you could just spot some problems. Here's one that I would suggest is worth exploring. Okay.
Mm.
And we're kind of looking at this under the hood right now. And I also want to disclose something just to try to be legal on this one. If you were to look inside of one of our investment models, we have some positions in biotechnology right now. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they're recently added. I'm going to talk a little bit about why I tend to be bullish on this as a concept, but I want to be clear. I'm not making a recommendation. I'm just disclosing that we are doing this in our practice so that we're above board, okay? One of the reasons that we did that is, one, we recognized from a sector rotation perspective, the markets, the healthcare was soft. Within that, biotechnology is in an interesting space right now. We see biotech as a feeder for big pharma, but here's the catch, right? I see artificial intelligence as a significant revolution in how quickly drug companies are able to test, model, and iterate and potentially bring new drugs to market cheaper, faster, and with higher efficacy.
Right, and imagine what that does for margins.
Oh, it's huge. And here's the really wild one is, since we have essentially mapped the human genome at this point, we just haven't been able to figure out how all the variables interact. AI can process data in orders of magnitude more than humans can. And so the ability to analyze and create pattern recognitions that may ultimately lead to individually and personalized medicine that's applicable in pharma is, to me, staggering in terms of the investment frontier. Imagine the idea that, you know, cancer is a big word, but everybody's cancer is unique to their own biology. What if you could actually custom make a cancer drug that would work for each person like a lock and a key?
Mm-hmm.
I think AI can make that possible. We're just early on in it.
Interesting.
And so that to me is extraordinary opportunity. So we are already trying to start positioning in those spots, even though that may be a 10-year long trend. Long-term investing, that's where how you get in early, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's a super long answer to like, how do we look between the lines? Try to project like, where are the really big picture trends going to move us?
That's a really good example of actually, what are you watching right now that maybe other people aren't? And you're basically saying, hey, the big overall trend is big tech, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
All you hear on a news cycle is NVIDIA, and other similar companies. And you're like, wait a minute, like, how does AI's computing changed the world.
Yeah.
And
my personal opinion is that the United States economy is a technology-based economy.
Mm-hmm.
And while we talk about manufacturing, I think robots will do more of it than people, and that that's political rhetoric, that that's just not the way it's going to go down. I think the way that we're utilizing technology is going to be the future of our economy. And so In fact, I think when you look at like the S&P 500, they'll ultimately start to break up the technology sector
into sub-sectors. Literally subsectors of like biotech,
because it's just too big as a single sector, and it will just, it won't make sense. It's like, well, 60% of our economy is one sector. Like, no, that sector needs to be fractured and be represented.
It gets muddied pretty quick if it gets that large.
Look, we're super long on this segment. Let's do
this. Let's do this. Yeah. When we get back, why don't we talk about the other thing? Like, what shouldn't you be talking to an advisor about?
Yeah, what are the questions that aren't going to get you any traction? That's a great idea, but let's grab this break first. Stick around, everybody, on the flip side of it. What are some questions? We'll ask some more questions that you might want to ask your advisor, but definitely some questions you go, yeah, that's a black hole. You don't want to go there.
Okay, let's do it.
Stick around. We'll be right back. I am Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQE.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
Okay, Matt, we ran a little long on the segment, so we're going to just talk fast and get caught up here.
Questions
to ask.
We do.
A financial advisor, or questions not worth asking your financial advisor.
Okay? Hey, Dave, what stock should I buy right now?
Okay, you should.
I want a hot tip.
Like chicken stock. I don't know. Like that.
Go
that
to question, Reddit, Matt. Go to Reddit.
Exactly. It's like we're asking the wrong question. That's a stockbroker question. That's from like probably the 70s, maybe the early 80s.
How many times do you get that though? I get it all the time.
I get people like, hey, what should you buy? Like, what should I be buying right now?
Uh huh. Yeah.
And you know, my standard answer to that is, oh, definitely pork bellies.
You actually say that?
I do. All the time. Pork bellies. You can't go wrong.
Wow.
Right? And it's obviously a snarky answer, right? Like, really, you're recommending I go buy commodities? It's like, you know what? Maybe you could go to the lamb show or go to the fair and bid on the rotary auction or something like that. That'd be a great investment. You know, and the kids win, too. So it's just – the question is always really frustrating, as if we don't all have access to the same information.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like,
yeah.
This idea that there's some super secret handshake where my favorite is when people come in and they genuinely believe it's like, well, hey, I've got like $1,000 and I need to buy a house. Can you turn this into like $100,000 down payment so I can make a house, buy a house in 4 months?
You're like sitting there like, if I knew how to do that, do you think I would be giving you advice, or would I just do it with my own money and then peace out to the Bahamas and you'd never see me again?
This has been my point forever. Is anytime you see like one of those silly ads that says that, you know, the 25-year-old who cracked the code of the market and, you know, won everything, it's like, why would you give that secret away if you had a hack for the market?
Right?
Right? No, they don't have a hack for the market. What they do is they have a hack for making you think they have a hack to the market and taking your money so that you can then say, well, I paid you for this idea, right? And then you can go try it yourself and screw it up. So
yeah.
I just don't like that at all. And that question implies to me, oh, you want you're a trader, right? You're not talking about investing in financial planning. You're talking about trading.
Here's another one on the flip side. We just talked about the person that's like, take that $1,000, turn it into $1 million. How many people have you had that are the exact opposite, where they're like, can you just guarantee I never lose anything? Like, I can't lose a penny. Like, you get those people too.
Yeah. Well, here's the funny thing. I can guarantee you won't lose a penny, but I can't guarantee you won't lose purchasing power.
Talk to the listener that doesn't understand purchasing power. Okay. What do you mean?
Purchasing power is the idea that, like, you could bury your money in the backyard, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as long as nobody else finds it, when you get back, the same number of dollars should be in that coffee can as when you put it there. The problem is that dollars from 10 years ago don't keep up with inflation. So you can't, just think about it this way, right? Think about...
We talked about this on the radio show last week, I think.
Shoot, 20 years ago, gas was $1 a gallon.
Well, 20...
Or something like that. $2 a gallon, lost four.
I think the dollar's lost over 40%, almost half of its purchasing power since like 2005. So over the last 20 years, it's almost lost half.
Yeah, that's what I mean about purchasing power, is that people have this... absent knowledge, right? People tend to focus on the things that they do know, right? So, like, well, I know how many dollars were there, And so I want to make sure that that same number is there when I come back to it. And it's a simplified version of, I don't care about the return of on my investment. I care about the return of my investment. It's like, well, it's not really an investment if that's all you're doing, right? An investment, by definition, in my opinion, ought to include outperformance above and beyond purchasing power, right?
Right.
So we're not just trying to hold steady. That would just be maintaining, right? An investment should be improving in value.
Right. And in order to improve in value, like, you have to realize that inflation is real.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that come in and want a financial plan, they always just look at it, not everyone, because a lot of people are really savvy investors, but some people come in and they're just like, well, you know, if I have this much money, $100,000, and I spend $1,000 a month, you know, I can last this long.
And you can. You just can't guarantee your purchasing power will keep up.
Right. They don't account for the fact that your $5 cheeseburger turns into a $10 cheeseburger.
Right.
And then the numbers don't number. Like, that $1,000 a month doesn't mean what it used to.
I remember when Taco Bell had the 59, 79, and 99 cent menu.
So I haven't been to a Taco Bell, I got to admit, because of the celiac thing in like 6 years. But I remember back when chalupas were like $1.50.
Yeah. And, you know, now it's like $5 or $6.
Right.
So, I mean, there's your sign, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Here's this also, by the way, when you talk about investing, this is why when somebody says, well, should I just buy gold? I know it's not one of your questions on your list, but it kind of makes me cringe because I go, look, gold is, it doesn't do anything. It's inert, right? Gold is its own tradable market. But what gold you're really trying to say is, I think that the dollar is unstable. And so if I buy gold, I should be able to preserve my purchasing power. And that's a fairly reasonable investment thesis. But people buying gold thinking it will outperform the market, what you're trying to do is own gold in a time when the market's going down and gold's not, right? That's what you're doing, is you're saying, well, maybe I can time the safety trade. And as gold becomes popular because other stuff is broken, it will look like I'm doing really well, right? But I don't see that. I mean, gold's not out there producing something. Right. When you invested in, I don't know, Tesla back in the day, they make cars. Like, they created something that didn't exist before. So value was created. Gold doesn't create new value. It just doesn't disappear.
You actually missed number 7 on my list. That was one of the questions. Should I, the person that walks in and says, should I buy gold, the crypto, or any options right now? And you know, you've had a lot of people ask that question.
I have.
Well, so you're answering something that is relevant.
Okay. I mean, and it's just, gold is a hedging mechanism. I still think crypto is, I think crypto is speculation.
I don't hate the thing of buying gold nearly as much as I do crypto. But this is my personal bias, right? Like, I just look at crypto and I'm like, I just think the bigger fool theory every time I hear about crypto, right? Like, you just got to be hopeful that someone's willing to pay you in US dollars, right?
Yeah.
For the thing that you perceive has value.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're launching a new cryptocurrency every 5 seconds, right?
Right.
And so I'm like, the space is so diluted.
Yeah.
And what's the flavor of the month, you know?
The cryptography has value. Right. Like, the idea of a blockchain has a function that could be useful. But the idea that tokens from a blockchain are just inherently valuable because they exist just doesn't make sense to me. And when somebody says, well, what about the US dollar? I mean, isn't that the same thing? And I go, you're not entirely wrong. Right. You're really not. The difference is, right now, the US dollar is represented by, you know, the US government, and they have a military.
I just love the way that Munger and Warren Buffett both talked about cryptocurrency, right?
Yeah,
and they're just like,
it's vapor.
Yeah. And, well, I just love their take on a lot of things. Have you ever heard the Munger talk about Elon Musk right before he died? It was like,
no.
It was like a month before he died. And he's like, you know, everyone wants to say that Elon is the most fantastic individual of all time. And he's like, and I can't argue the guy's success, right? Like, look at how he's been able to revolutionize the world with the EVs and everything. And he's like, but how many times has that man been on the verge of losing everything and then comes back from it?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, I can't invest in him simply because I don't believe that you can flirt with that line over and over and over again and not eventually fall off.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so I love the way that they approached principles. And I think cryptocurrency is the same way. Like, you flirt with the line, right? Like SEC regulation and hacking and all the other things that can completely make this thing a bust. And I'm like, we'll see.
The longer I'm an advisor, the more I gravitate toward the Buffett and Munger philosophy on investing.
I love it. Buy the companies that have value.
Well,
that are
and I really separate the difference between trading and investing.
Well,
they are not the same.
Right. And okay? That comment that they made one time of like, would you rather buy a really good company at a slightly higher price or a really bad company at a steep discount? You know what I mean?
Exactly. Look, because of time, we have to take our last break. So we're just going to cue the music. We're going to hit that. We're going to come back. However many more questions we can cram in, oh, we'll do it.
I've got five more for you.
Oh, we're going to do it fast.
Yeah.
But we got to help you guys out. Figure out if you're going to work with a pro, what should you be asking? Stick around and we'll find out. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
Got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM at 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Now, I mean, it might actually, not for this show, right?
But we're going to talk about that big, beautiful bill.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's what you get in the meantime. Anyway, welcome back to the True Wealth Show. Last few minutes here, we are trying to help our listeners to discern. If you were out there thinking, I need to talk to a financial advisor, what are good questions? What are bad questions? Matt, just what are the questions that you want to try to cram in the last few minutes here?
David, can't I just do it all myself with a robo-advisor? Can't I just go to Vanguard or Fidelity and just skip you?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah. I mean, like, actually, that is the answer. Just remember that when you do that, these larger companies, simply because they need to manage their own liability,
mm-hmm.
are going to really not be able to offer you much in the way of meaningful advice.
Right.
Right. They're going to keep it very down the fairway of, this is the stuff that we talk about. This is what our commitment to, and anything out of those lines we're not going to deal with, because we don't want to invite liability in where you could come after our deeper pockets.
Yeah, what you're really not getting largely is the planning portion.
Yeah,
what happens when your emotions hit,
yeah.
and then you start making rash decisions on your investments.
Correct. So it's
it's different.
You can DIY this stuff, right?
You can,
and so you don't have to have an advisor. That's not what I'm saying. What I think is you have to look out for yourself financially,
mm-hmm.
okay? And so if you won't do it, get somebody to help you, okay? But you don't have to have an advisor, but will you do the work, right? Will you change your own oil? Will mm-hmm. you mow your own lawn? Will you do the dishes? Will you make the bed? Will you do the million other things in your life and this?
Right.
Well, that's the question.
Yeah. excuse me. Oh, my goodness. I don't know if we already talked about this one, but this is one of my favorites. Can you help me beat the market?
It depends. Right. Mm. It depends on what your definition of the market is, first of all.
That is a really good, because there's so many indexes out there.
Yep.
And the performance of those indexes swings so dramatically. Like, if you look at the Russell 2000 compared to the S&P 500 over the last 5 years.
Yep.
I mean, they're both an index.
Yep.
But guess what? Small cap companies have been absolutely hammered compared to those mega cap companies.
Yeah, so I will ask, what index are we talking about that we're going to benchmark against? So, define the market for me, define the terms that you're willing to invest in, define the volatility you're willing to tolerate.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question.
And so all of those come into play, and the answer is, could you? Maybe, right? It kind of depends on the terms of engagement. If you say, like, you know, can you beat my savings account? Yeah, there's a pretty good chance, especially if you give me like 10 years. Like, I, you know, there's no guarantees in the world, but I'm like, financial negligence if you didn't.
Right? Yeah, right. What's one question that when people ask it to you that you like despise? Is there anything that you can think of like right out of the gate? Maybe despise is a strong word, but is there anything where you're like, that's probably a waste of your time to ask that?
Oh, no, because here's the thing. I'm really tolerant. what I'm usually looking for is when somebody asks a question, is there, are they really asking that question, or is there a question buried inside of
it? Is there ever like a red flag question where you're like, if you're asking that, we might not be a real good fit? Like, well, this is alarming.
One of the questions that people say is, hey, you know, if I want to buy this thing, will you buy it for me? Right. And so here's the thing. Here's the reason that this is sort of red flaggy. It's not always a red flag, but what it sets up is when a customer comes into a financial advisor and says, hey, I want to make all the financial decisions and I want to be in charge of every decision that we're going to make. You're a fiduciary for me, but I'm going to make the decisions. And then I think, well, wait a second here. If you're making the decisions, aren't you really doing it yourself?
So why pay me?
So why would you pay me? And what I've found is that those people are usually saying, well, when it goes well, I want the credit for it. But if it goes poorly, I need someone to blame.
Mm.
And I go, I don't like playing the game where I get all of the downside and none of the upside.
Like,
right? As an advisor, I'm like, that's pretty awful. So so the bigger is like, if somebody doesn't want to take the advice and somebody doesn't want to engage the way that we engage, I'm okay if you want to do it a different way. We just probably aren't a great fit
so,
for you.
David, I know that there's someone listening to the show right now and they're thinking to themselves, wow, I like this Dave guy. Or on the rare occasion, they're like, I like Matt too. But what if they've listened to this whole thing and they're like, you know what? These guys are my people. I need to sit down and finally address the elephant in the room because I keep putting it off. It's that thing that's in the back corner of the closet. Let's finally, you know, get a plan going. Let's get something in line. What's the easiest way for them to reach us for that free consultation?
Okay. It's the way that's easy for you. Okay. If email is easy, email us, info@littlejohnfs.com. If it's a phone call, just call 541-375-0898. If it's a text, you can text that same number, right?
We're trying to make ourselves accessible.
You can go to our webpage. There's a chat bot on there. If you chat with it, a real person actually gets the notification and will respond to you. If it's after hours, it will tell you, hey, we'll get back to you when somebody's at the desk, right? But like all these different ways to walk in the front door. The goal here is, and by the way, there's no obligation for this. We want you to know, we want it to be a good fit for you too. So give us a call if we can help, and we're happy to. If you don't want to work with us, it's fine. But find somebody if you're not going to do it yourself, right?
I like that.
All right. Well, look, that's the music. It's time we got to wrap. So until next time, my name is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You've been listening to True Wealth. Thanks for tuning in on News Radio 93.9 FM at 1240 KQEN.